Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and some stories from the birthday boy, Ray Lloyd, celebrating his 99th birthday this weekend in Grover Beach, California. He grew up a little ways inland from there in Bakersfield, which reminds me, the Navy vet we met a few weeks ago, Walter Granger, and his crew are still raising money for the Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial, which will be unveiled on Veterans Day in Bakersfield this November. If you'd like to support that cause, you can link to it at hometownheroesradio.com. Another group of volunteers with Welcome Home Military Heroes made this a very special 99th birthday weekend for Ray Lloyd. It's something they've been doing for countless veterans, young and old, on California's Central Coast since 2010. Maybe we ought to focus an entire episode around their efforts one of these days. But for today, we're focusing on Ray, who got well acquainted with the big guns on the cruiser USS Portland and the carrier USS Kitkin Bay.
Yeah, well, I think it was about 12, if I'm not mistaken. You had your gun captain, your pointer and trainer. You had your sight angle and deflection guy running that stuff. And then you had, there were three loaders that I don't know where. I'm talking about loading the ammunition into the fuse pots. And then you had the loaders up on the deck. And in those days, you had a hot shell man because the brass shell came out of the gun after they fired it, and somebody had to catch that. It was about 12 guys, as I remember. And that was a 5-inch 50, which was an old gun, which was replaced with a 5-inch 38. And that used powder bags and the projectiles separate, so you didn't have that hot shell flying out of the gun every time you shot it.
And if you are engaged with the enemy and firing away, how intense or exhausting of an experience is that when you're actually in the thick of that?
Well, of course, I was terrified like anybody else that had any sense would be. But I know during the battle, I figured, well, if I get killed here, what are my parents going to think if I'm killed here? And then I got to think of, what am I going to think? Anyway, that I was scared just like everybody else. If you weren't scared in those situations, there's something wrong with you, I can tell you that.
And when you feel that, when you experience that fear and the really not knowing if you're going to live through this, what do you do with that? How do you keep performing your job?
Of course, I'm scared, but when you're in the battle like that, things kind of, your mind gets more like you got a job to do and you better do it, because if you don't, they're going to get you first. At that early stage of the part of combat I had on the Portland, I was just learning what things, you know, happened or what have you. But when I got on the carrier and it was invasion after invasion, and we would stay with the Marines, giving them airport day after day, your stomach gets in a knot after a while because you know that you're in range of land-based bombers and they're coming. You just don't know when.
And I want to hear about that too, but I don't want to leave out this experience with the Portland, because very few people have been in situations like this. We don't know what it's like. But when that sun comes up and you start to understand the shape your ship is in, which wasn't good, and then how many other ships, some the same kind of ship, cruiser as yours, that sank in that battle, what is that like to open your eyes in the morning and come to grips with that reality?
Well, you know that you're playing for keeps when all that's going on. Of course, by the time the sun come up, any ship that was able was pulling out of there. They were trying to get away from the area altogether, and that's when they run into more trouble. That's when we lost the Juno. They were trying to get away, and the submarine got them. And that's something I've never understood. There were ships that knew the Juno was hit, and they kept right on going. They never stopped to help the men or nothing. I never could understand that. But that took place. But we were so short of men and so short of ships at the time that everything counted, you know, every ship counted. And when we were tied up to the coconut trees there, the first night we were there, the Japanese fleet came in again, but the South Dakota and one other battleship came in, and they fought them off. Otherwise, we was a sitting duck. As far as our gun was concerned, we were the side that was up against the island. We couldn't shoot anyway. So only one side of the ship would be able to shoot, and that would just be our two forward turrets and a 5-inch gun or so on the other side, because all that other stuff was damaged beyond, you know, any kind of repair. It gets your attention, and like I say, I was scared to death, but you got a job to do, and I think the more scared you get, the faster you work. That has something to do with it. We had been at general quarters, I forget how many hours it was, with no sleep, never left the gun for about 2.5 days. We were on that gun at general quarters. We had a bucket there. If nature called, there was the bucket, and that was it. They would bring us sandwiches and coffee, and they were Spam sandwiches and Navy coffee, and that was it. 3 times a day. There was nothing fancy.
Well, and you mentioned that when your time on the Portland came to an end, eventually you end up on this new carrier. How'd you feel about that? Because a cruiser is a big enough target. A carrier is what the enemy really wants to get.
Yeah, the carriers are the bullseye. But this was a small carrier. We call them Kaiser coffins, that they built on top of cargo ship hulls or tanker hulls or something. Anyway, we were very small.
Kaiser was the shipbuilder.
Yes, he was. He wanted to build these, and the Navy said they didn't want any part of them. Well, he knew Roosevelt. Roosevelt said build them, so that's what happened. And we operated between probably, I'd say, 20 and 25 planes. That's all we could handle. The small carriers, our job was we operated in groups of six, and we was always on the port side on the lead carrier of the group, and the other ones on the starboard side, and we'd be 2 abreast and far enough apart that we could operate aircraft. We had usually about 6 or 7 destroyers around the outside. We started in with this new carrier. Our first battle was at Saipan. That the big shots said it would take them 3 or 4 days to take over the island, and took about 6 weeks. We give the Marines air cover. That was our job. Crack of dawn until sunset, we were giving the Marines air cover and support. We was probably in our second or third week of trying to take Saipan, and they were having problems with the coordination between the Marines and the pilots. So anyway, they passed the word on the carrier to man the whale boat. So I was the engineer run the whale boat engine. They said to report to the hangar deck. So I go up there on the hangar deck, and the bosun mate and the bow hook, they were already there. Well, just as I walked up, the captain was there, and he was telling the bosun mate, I want you to go right straight in. He said, stay in the middle between Saipan and Tinian. And when you get straight off of a pier, he said, there's a pier there. You turn and go in, and there's intelligence officers you're going to be there for you to pick up. He said, okay, so now you understand this carrier's moving, and it's not going to slow down, because you just don't slow down when you know there's submarines and stuff around. So they lower us down. We get unhooked pretty easy. So we take off, and we go around there. And another thing the captain said, if you get in any kind of trouble, I'll send a destroyer through to help you. We take off, and the coxswain doing just like he was told, staying right in between the two islands. And we just get up in there good, and all of a sudden, go whoom, the water comes flying up around us. And they hadn't invaded Tinian yet, so they was firing at us with artillery. When that first swamp hit and I realized what it was, I grabbed the throttle, and the coxswain was getting ready to ring the bell for full throttle. I already had it jerked up and jumped over on the other side of the engine. That's the only protection we had. So anyway, we keep going, just holding that course, and the captain sees this from the carrier. He sends a destroyer, and that destroyer, he didn't want to be in there either. He come by us just as fast as one ever went, and every gun on it was working, shooting back at Tinian there. Well, that quieted him down, but the wake of that destroyer almost capsizes when it went by. But anyway, that took care of the artillery over there, and we got off the pier, and we started in. And I'm sitting there alongside the ensign, and I'm looking up there at the pier, and I don't see anybody. And we keep going in, and I guess we were probably, maybe 100 yards off or so. And all of a sudden, I see a guy running, and he's running on the pier, and the wood's flying up around him, you know. So the Japanese are shooting at him with a machine gun, and he keeps right on running. And then the other Marines, I guess they put some suppressed fire on him or something. They got that machine gun calmed down. He gets out to the end of the pier, and he doesn't even slow down. He's right off and in the water, and he starts swimming. So we pull up alongside of him and get him in. And then the coxswain turns the boat around, heads right straight out towards Tinian. And this guy, he was a major, a Marine major. And he says to the coxswain, where in the hell are you going? He says, I'm going out here to the middle of the channel. And he says, no, you're not. He says, cut across here. He had us cut across the way. Anyway, we got him over to the ship. Now our trouble started. Here's the carrier barreling along with a wake and everything else, and we're trying to hook up these big metal pulleys to pull this boat up out of the water. And I'm trying to hold the boat's position. I see some rust spots on the hull, and I'm trying to keep that one spot so that the bow hook and the coxswain can get the hold of this guy, the hooks. Man, I'm telling you, it was life and death there for about 5 minutes. Those steel things whipping around, about the time you'd think you'd get them, you'd be gone, and then you'd be back up, and they'd be laying in the bottom of the boat. It was wild, but anyhow, they finally got them all hooked up and pulled us up on the ship, and that was the end of that story there.
So obviously that was a new duty, having to operate that whale boat like that. And as far as the gun crew on the carrier, you are now the pointer?
Yeah, pointer is on the left side of the gun, the trainer's on the right-hand side. The trainer runs the gun port and starboard, or right and left, and the pointer up and down. And you have crosshairs that you match up when you're on a target. That was my job. And then, of course, that was a 5-inch 38, so we had two powder bags and a shell, projectile. And in those days, they had developed what they call proximity fuse. And any time it got within any, had a center beam or something, it would explode any aircraft. When the gun was loaded, I wouldn't know it, of course, because I'd be on the scope. And I had what you call a ring sight up above. You'd always use a ring sight, you know, get in the area, and then you'd drop down to your scope. And we had the most powerful optics on the ship. They were something else. I could look right up at the sun and just dial the sun right out of it with the dials on the... That took care of them diving out of the sun at you. But anyway, whenever the gun was loaded, I'd get a tap on my shoulder, back, whatever. That was the way it handled. Trainer, he and I would get on a plane, and we'd match up, and I'd pull the trigger. That was it, and we did that plenty of times.
What were you typically firing at?
On the carrier, we were always attacked by what we called Bettys. They were a twin-engine plane. They would come in with the torpedoes. They'd just get right on top of the water, maybe 10, 15 feet. Some of them would get as low, and some of them might be as high as 50 or 60 feet, just depend on, I guess, how much guts the pilot had. That's the way they'd come in, and of course, the trainer and I would just get on them, and we'd keep shooting. But the guns that really tore up the planes, and I tell you, I wouldn't have wanted to be in the planes, because we shot them down like flies, and they just keep coming. But the 40 millimeters, they were a quad that had four barrels. And let me tell you, when they cut down on an airplane, they just take it all to pieces. And then, of course, we had 20 millimeter mounts and 40s all the way around the ship. The air department that had aircraft with 50 calibers, they'd stick them in the stanchions. A couple of those guys would feed the belt through it. They weren't even part of it, but they'd get in on the act, keep shooting. We didn't have to worry about hitting our own ship because the gun would cut out. When I would train or go too far, or I'd go too high, flight deck could be up there and cut out. So we just keep shooting until the gun cut out.
It's break time again, but we have more memories to come with this now 99-year-old who received a surprise birthday vehicle salute this weekend in Grover Beach, California. How about Ray Lloyd's memories of the Battle of Leyte Gulf, the day he shot down an enemy plane at point-blank range, and the time he says a kamikaze probably had his name on it? What was it that saved his life so he could experience that 99th birthday this weekend? Find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.